Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another sort of semi-kind of exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
I'm sorry I qualified the exciting part. I guess it comes from... You know, some people aren't as excited as we are about the fluctuations in spreadsheets and the changes in prices in different parts of the world. But, you know, for those of you that are, it's maybe more than semi sort of kind of exciting. For those of you that aren't, it's probably not even sort of semi kind of. So when you average it all together, that's what we're planning. No, that's not. Hopefully it'll be better than that. Okay, this is The Personal Wealth Coach, and we are hoping to talk to you about the economy, finance, maybe personal finance.
If you average everything together, that's called the mean, and that's just mean of you to do that.
That's not nice at all. That's kind of the definition.
Right, exactly.
Yikes.
Anyway, you're right. This is The Personal Wealth Coach, and The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a weird radio program with a couple of guys who do bad puns.
And are bald.
It is also, and are bald and bearded.
Yes.
And the guy who said and bald first has a black beard, and the guy who said and bearded has a gray beard.
You haven't looked at my beard in a while.
Well, it's got a. I'm looking at it right now. It's got little streaks of gray in it, but it isn't. It's still mostly black. I would call it a black beard.
Yeah. You could call it that if you wish. Just in comparison to your white beard, everything else looks black. So it's fine.
And the guy with the white beard is Jeff, and the guy with the not very white beard is Jake.
Yes.
Yeah. And we have been doing this for a long time.
This kind of conversation has been going on between the two of us my entire speaking lifetime, because the guy with the white beard is my dad. People often think we're brothers. We're partners, but and maybe in a philosophical, spiritual sense, we're brothers.
I would say eschatological, but that's all right.
Oh, you would say words like that. Those have anyway, more than one syllable.
The Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of a registered an investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, that does portfolio management and gives investment advice that is registered with the Securities and Exchange, the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which does not in any way imply that they approve or anything else. It just means if an investment advisory firm has to be registered, and in order to be, if it has over $100 million under management, it has to be registered with the SEC, and that's as far as it goes.
Yeah. They don't say you're good. They do occasionally say you're bad to people, and that kind of makes headlines.
Right.
But you never hear that the SEC endorses a company. Nope. We're not endorsed by the SEC, just because that's kind of like saying, I haven't gotten a ticket all year, and that means that the police think I'm nice. No, that doesn't say anything about what the police think.
Well, the insurance company thinks I'm nice.
Yeah, the insurance company likes me.
Yeah.
Maybe they like me more if I got more tickets, because they could charge me more. I don't know. Anyway, back to the disclosures. Just because we're registered to give investment advice, which is what we just said, the firm is registered to give investment advice, that doesn't mean that that's what this is. Investment advice is custom tailored to the person receiving it, which is really hard to do in a podcast radio environment. I mean, we could do it, but it would have to be like a direct broadcast. It would be like a narrow cast. So that's more like a phone. This is not a phone or a team.
But we're not phonies either.
And we're not phonies. So we don't give investment advice on the air. We give education on the air. We're trying to give you the tools to know when you need advice. Hopefully that will be helpful. Say that 10 times fast. And the information that we receive or that we disseminate on this program. Oh, you thought I was going to give it, didn't you? You started to have a pained look on your face.
No. I'm waiting to hear you say it.
Come from sources that we deem to be reliable, though we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said or unsaid information, much less written or unwritten. There.
I'm impressed.
I added to
it.
That's
really cool.
I didn't lower my volume and speak at double speed, though. I need to get working on that.
And if you would like to, it's presuming today is June 4th, 2022, If you would like to fire us some questions via email, we'll endeavor to address them on the air. And our email addresses are jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com.
That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or the Personal Wealth Coach. So what happened this week across the markets?
Did something happen?
I believe the markets opened on Monday and closed on Monday and proceeded.
No,
they didn't. We have news. The market was closed for some reason on Monday. We just skipped all trading on Monday. It was a memorial event.
In reading the media reports on what happened in the S&P 500 after the market closed on Friday, it was fascinating to see the range of numbers for the week.
Yes,
because the standard way of looking at a week is five trading days. And so people are actually going back to from the close on Thursday of last week and counting in Friday of last week and this week's stuff. And some people weren't. It was really interesting to see the spread.
When we're talking about this, we're not talking about low rent type publications. We're talking about some of the major publications on the planet doing this. Oh, algorithms have taken over. Al Gore knew it at the beginning.
He did. Al Gore invented them. He just ask him. He'll tell you.
And he was the vice president for a saxophone player who had maybe rhythm. So Al Gore rhythm is what we use to run. No, bad pun.
Bad.
You gave that as the disclosure at the beginning. We give bad puns. So go ahead.
We do. Okay. The S&P 500 stock index is the one that we use to indicate what's going on in the market. We also look at another one called the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, just to give some contrast. The S&P 500 seesawed up and down all week as the bears and the bulls fought one another excitedly. And even though the end of the week, it was down 1.2% for the week, it's still doing pretty well because it is up 5.3% from where it was 3 weeks ago at the bottom of this correction so far. It's down 14.28% from its top at the beginning of the year. And since corrections start when the market goes down 10% and they turn into bear markets when the market's down 20% at a close, we are in a correction.
Well, and I have that's all we're in. I have to interject here. Economists are the most unsexy at measuring bottoms. Yeah. It was a bottom joke.
You're really into the dad jokes today. Anyway.
I qualify.
Anyway. We're still in a correction, and I know that there is and I've heard people say the market's doing horribly this year. No, it's really not doing horribly this year.
It's not doing fantastically, but it's not horrible either.
We're in a correction. We've been saying for some time we needed a correction, and we needed to be in a correction, and we're in a correction, and it hasn't shaken out everything it needs to shake out yet. There are still zombie companies out there, and that's one of the reasons we're in a correction. What's a zombie company? A zombie company is one where their earnings will not be able to pay the interest on their loans indefinitely. They have to raise their earnings substantially to be able to pay the interest on their outstanding loans when these loans start rolling over in this higher interest rate environment. And you say, okay, well, that's some meme company like AMC or GameStop or something like it. No, American Airlines, by the way, is in that same category. If you look at all their loans outstanding, if interest rates go up and their earnings don't go up a bunch, and fuel is hurting them pretty badly right now, they're on a death spiral, which they've been in before. They've been in bankruptcy before.
Multiple times.
But that's one of the things that's dragging the market down right now. There are companies out there whose profit margins are being squeezed by interest rates, whose profit margins are being squeezed by the rising price of fuel. They're zombie companies, and they're in the S&P 500, and that drags the index down. Now, let's look over at, let's see, it's the S&P 500, I said it was up 5.3% from its low point 3 weeks ago. It's up 83.63% from March of 2020. In other words, in just over 2 years, the S&P 500 has risen 83.63%, and I talked to a guy yesterday who said the market has done horribly the past couple of years. Yeah, you're right. It's only up 83.63%. But that's the perception, and that's what life is. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, we look at mid-cap value because it's kind of the opposite in many ways of the S&P 500 that's dominated by large growth companies. The Mid-Cap Value Index, by definition, is full of mid-sized corporations.
That's why it's called mid-cap.
That are where the stocks are valued on the market based on not based on what they think the earnings are going to be in 5 years or 10 years or whatever, but on what they're doing today. And the Mid-Cap Value Index did drop 1.78% for the week, but it's only down 4.45% from its high and down 1% from a year ago. So that gives you some idea.
Less than 5% down from the very top of the market.
Yep.
Versus some parts of the market, which are really, really down.
Well, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, as I said, was down 1% from a year ago. It's down about less than 5% from its high. So whether or not your portfolio is in a correction depends on where you're invested. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note interest rate went up, which is good in a sense, because that's what the Fed wants it to do. And considering what the Fed is doing with its balance sheet, it should go up. It went up to 2.942% to end the week. That's about twice the yield it carried at the beginning of this year. The yield curve is positive. 90-day T-bill is at 1.185%, and the 30-year Treasury bond is at 3.096, with the 10-year being in the middle at 2.942. Why is that important?
It means it's got a higher yield for a longer maturity. If you make a long-term loan, you get a higher interest rate than when you make a short-term loan. That's very healthy. Yep.
And it's just the reality is that a positive yield curve is a good sign, because recessions are so far in the 20th century, since we've had treasury yield curves, our 20th and 21st century, recessions are preceded by inverted yield curves. And we don't have an inverted yield curve. It's that simple. So it's kind of like a barometer. The yield curve is very much like a barometer. If you live on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico and you have a barometer in your house and it drops precipitously very quickly and goes down way below normal, there's a very high probability there's a hurricane headed your way.
Precipitous precipitation?
You got it.
There it is.
And it's probably a good idea to board up your windows and leave town. So that's the yield curve is kind of like a barometer. And the barometer is still indicating fair weather. Maybe some isolated thunderstorms and things like that, but nothing in the way of a hurricane or a recession. So that's good. West Texas Intermediate crude oil, which is the benchmark for fuel prices here in the United States, rose another 4.5% to $120.29 per barrel. So, suggesting, you notice I put the word suggesting in here, that the pain at the pump is far from over.
Yeah.
We are going to see higher fuel prices for some time. And there's some very good reasons we're seeing higher fuel prices.
I don't know. I don't know if I would call them good when I'm getting fuel in my car. I call them horrible reasons, but they're good reasons for the prices to go up. Mm.
We're only operating at about, depending on who you read, 89 to 93% capacity in refineries in the United States. Why? Because refineries are down in various places in the United States because of maintenance that they're doing on the refineries.
Yeah.
It's that simple. And there have been some refineries that shut down during the pandemic and haven't opened up again. They're not going to open up again because they weren't particularly profitable. Why did they shut down? Because the price of oil dropped through the floor and the oil companies that run the refineries were losing money vigorously on their refineries. And they said, this will probably never come back. So they shut the thing down. And oddly enough, then laid off everybody who was working at the refinery. And oddly enough, you can't just say, hey, let's turn the refinery back on.
Yeah. And this is a good time to be having this conversation, because it was 2 years ago this month that the price of oil was not only much lower, it was negative. For about a week, people were actually paying someone else to take their oil away because they didn't have room for it. Because I know this is hard for people to remember. It's only 2 years ago. Hard to remember. This is in the height of the lockdown, where the vast majority of the planet just said to everyone, stay home, don't drive. And That meant that all this oil that was being produced for summer travel and for all that good stuff didn't have anybody to buy it. And you can't really stop the flow, so it filled up all the available storage spaces. Well, the good news was that there were a lot of tankers that didn't have any jobs to take oil back and forth, so they all got rented out to just be floating oil tanks. They just sat there with the oil in it. People were literally paying, and they had just pumped the stuff up out of the ground. They had it there, and they were paying people to take it away from them, not selling it to them. So come forward 2 years, and it's now $124, almost $125 a barrel for the same stuff that they were paying $30 a barrel for you just to take it away. It's pretty amazing. Well, there's a story in there somewhere.
Well, there's a lot of story in
there.
One of the reasons the price of oil is up, there's actually several reasons that the price of fuel is up. And it's up a lot more elsewhere, by the way, than it is in the United States.
That's correct.
And it's kind of like inflation. I've listened to people tell me that it's Biden's fault we have inflation. It's the Democrats' fault we have inflation. Well, to the best of my knowledge, the Democrats and President Biden have very little effect on England, where they have 8.7% inflation, or on Europe, where they're having record inflation, too. So
this is just as bad as when
everywhere.
The Democrats during the Trump administration were blaming Trump for things that absolutely were not in his purview. They're nowhere around anything he could affect. But because he's in the Oval Office and they don't agree with him, they can blame him. Well, the Republicans are now doing it for Biden. Biden has had very little impact on pricing of anything. He's not had a great impact on anything since he's been in there. So blaming him for things, you're just giving him more power than he has in your own mind. It's just amazing. It happens all the time, though. It's a normal thing. I've stopped telling people to stop doing it.
And we've said this before, but I still get questions about why is the price of fuel up when we have plenty of oil in the United States? Well, because we're exporting a lot of the oil. Well, the question comes back then, why are we exporting oil? We're exporting oil because the people in Europe and Japan and lots of other places are willing to pay a lot of money for oil.
I've got great parallel.
If you're in a free market scenario, and we are in free market economy, the oil company says, okay, if somebody in Europe, by the way, if you look at the price of Brent crude, which is the equivalent of West Texas Intermediate, it's higher than it is here in the United States. Why? Because of shipping costs from here to there. People are willing to pay a lot of money for oil someplace else, then the oil company, to the degree it can, is going to ship oil to somewhere else, and you're going to have to match their price if you want oil.
Yeah, there's
gasoline.
There's a great parallel here. At the beginning of the pandemic, everybody was hunting, what are we going to do? We got to get vaccines. We got to figure something out. Vaccines are under development. What's going on? So the United States kind of paved the way for a sort of unknown company to work on the vaccine, Moderna. The Germans said, hey, we're going to take our top of the line company besides Bayer. Pfizer's up there. It is one of the best in the world. We're going to make the vaccine. And so there's neck and neck race between the Germans and the Americans. And they got there at about the same time. And then the Americans got a lot of vaccines and the Europeans were told to wait. But wait a minute. Pfizer was making more vaccines than Moderna. What happened there? Well, we were willing to pay more for it. The United States was willing to pay a lot of money for the vaccine, and the Europeans weren't. They waited. So we paid the money for the vaccine, and we got it first. In Europe, they're paying more money for gasoline now. They're paying more money for natural gas. They're paying more money for oil. It has something to do with a really bad neighbor. And there's like a tree ordinance where a tree was over a property line. That's a tank ordinance. Sorry.
There's a tank. There's a tank over the property line.
Right. There's a lot of tanks over the property line, and that affects business. It really seriously does. People get afraid. They're willing to spend a lot more to buy things from people that aren't threatening them with guns. I don't know why that would be, but actually I do. I'm being silly. This makes sense that people are willing to, and we have a question that lines up with that.
Okay.
Do you mind if I throw that in there? You wanted me to answer this one anyway. Our chief questioner,
Inquisitor
John, had a series of fantastic questions for us this week. And the first one that I'm going to answer isn't the first one he asked, but it fits in really nicely with this. As is tradition, he's taken a digital picture of his paper, Wall Street Journal, and then emailed it to me so that I may look at the digital analog version of the Wall Street Journal. And his question that I'm going to hit here is on gold. Why is there a difference in gold prices for one troy ounce? So we can kind of look at it. There's four prices listed in the Wall Street Journal. And the spread is pretty far between them. The difference is it's like $102 between the lowest and the top. So there's four different prices on one troy ounce of gold. And there's $100 between the lowest price and the highest price. So why? They're listing four places for gold prices, which is just a drop in the bucket for the number of places that have different gold prices. When it comes to like West Texas Intermediate oil, crude oil, or Brent crude oil, those are two numbers that we hear quoted all the time because those are two really big markets for them. Brent is a British-based, a UK-based pricing system, but the Norwegians are involved in this too. So basically, a lot of the oil from the Middle East and Europe is priced in Brent because they have kind of one marketplace where they all get together and they bid on it. It's not completely one marketplace, but at least it's semi-organized and most of the buyers know most of the sellers. Okay, that's not the way it works with gold. There are thousands upon thousands of gold, I'm going to put air quotes around this, exchanges, maybe more, maybe tens of thousands. And that goes from the collectible coin seller in the mall to we buy gold guys that stand on the corner of the street spinning signs to massive establishments with vaults that are as big as a warehouse. There are so many different places, and each seller tends to have their own price to sell by. It tends to fall within a range just because if your price is too high, they'll go to somewhere else. But if you're buying from somebody in India, you have to ship the gold. That's an additional cost. Just like our oil is less expensive, West Texas Intermediate is less expensive than Brent. Why? It's basically the same quality oil. Why is Brent more expensive than West Texas Intermediate? Because the Brent oil includes already shipped oil from a lot of places and more expensive drilling. So it costs more to drill in the North Sea than it costs to frack in Texas or to dig a hole in your backyard in Houston. That's a little bit of hyperbole there. It's not quite that easy. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, actually, the market doesn't care where the oil comes from.
That's true. It doesn't.
But
it's just how it tastes. If it's right. Sweet, it's more expensive than not.
That's
sweet.
Right.
Sweet crude.
But the fact that Brent oil is a little more sweet, it's cheaper to refine into the lighter fuels that people use. It's immediately available in Europe, where the big demand is. People are willing to pay a little more for that than they are for U.S. oil because it's not quite as sweet. And the other thing is, it's kind of like you pay a little more for something if you add the shipping costs in. And the demand right now, big time, is in Europe. And the oil in the United States costs money to get to Europe, so that's just the way it works out. We add shipping costs. When you look at the West Texas Intermediate crude price in the United States, it's not the same. If you buy West Texas Intermediate crude in Europe, you're going to pay about the same as you pay for Brent. That's which is why there's two different reasons, two different numbers. If you really want to see about gold, for example, you're looking at gold around $1,850, $1,847 an ounce right now. You can buy a Credit Suisse 1 ounce fine gold bar sealed in a tamper-resistant container for about $2,000 an ounce. But that doesn't mean you're likely to want to do that. The price of gold, for instance, one of those numbers, John, that you sent us, on gold. Let's see, which one was it? The one for 2000, the Handy and Hartman fabricated. That's not just gold. Handy and Hartman fabricated bar. First off, they come in 400-ounce bars. So it's 400 times that price per ounce that you're looking there. And secondly, those are historical bars that aren't made anymore. In other words, if you have a bar that was fabricated by Handy and Hartman 20 years ago, the mean price for that is $2,040.96 in the Wall Street Journal there. Engelhardt
Industrial.
Engelhardt Industrial, you have to show up at a BASF facility that is buying and selling gold and physically transfer the gold at a BASF facility to get that $853 an ounce. So $1,853 an ounce. So that's the point. If you want to buy gold or sell gold, one of the things that's really important is to recognize that if you go to buy gold, it will be a higher price than if you go to sell gold.
Yes.
And secondly, the quantity that you're selling at a time will affect the price. And thirdly, I could go on and on and on.
Yeah.
It changes moment to moment.
Yeah.
So the price of gold is not, as Jake said, it isn't a fixed thing someplace where there is a New York gold exchange or whatever. It swings around and there is a spread between buy and sell. And there's a lot goes into the price of gold that is most people don't understand. And when they see the price of gold advertised in many cases is the price that a commercial gold dealer will sell gold to you for. You try to sell it back to the same dealer, and in many cases the price goes down. And the other thing is if your gold is other than a stamped bar in a sealed container, then there's some question, obviously, whether or not it's gold.
Then you have you have to have it assayed, which costs money.
Yeah, it's rough. And that's just life.
This is the gold, time when fine gold can be rough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You got it. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have another question from Inquisitor John, and he just knows how to ask questions that I like to answer. This is a big enough question that it's available for lots of input from all sources. His question, he actually asked the question two times, and it's basically the same question. Shadow banks, bank question. What are lightly regulated shadow banks, and what was the warning that Jamie Dimon predicted last week? And in the Wall Street Journal article here, there's a little area in a headline that says, here is where to look for the next Wall Street blow up. I love that. It's a great headline. One of the reasons is, it says, the second reason is that there's a massive unknown amount of private debt issued by lightly regulated shadow banks. What's a shadow bank? Anything that holds money and loans money for someone else is a bank. I know that's weird. Doesn't fall under banking regulations. The word shadow bank kind of started in the 1970s when referring to a series of limited partnerships in real estate as well as other things. So let me give you some examples. What is a shadow bank? If you make a loan to a friend who wants to buy a hamburger for $10, that's a banking transaction. You just loaned money that you wish to receive a $10 return. You gave $10, you want $10 back. If you start to charge interest on that, it becomes more of a professional banking transaction, but you're not a registered bank. What about if you go to a pawn shop and you say, hey, I'd like to give, hey, get, can you just hold this to the side? Don't sell it, but give me some money on it. And if I don't pay you back in a period of time, you can sell it. Well, that's collateral for a loan, isn't it?
Yep.
Payday loans. Car title loans, but it gets bigger. A lot of hedge funds, SoftBank, a Japanese-based big fund, is not a bank, and it's got bank in the name. Why has it got bank in the name? Well, because it makes a lot of loans as well, and that's how it makes money. This is important. If you think about big celebrities that are on the rocks. And the one that's a really famous one, though it's dating me because a lot of the people listening may not even have been alive during this period, Michael Jackson's estate before he died. He hadn't made money in a long time, and he was spending at a fabulously fast rate. He was spending money hand over fist. Where was he getting that money from? There's a lot of stories back then about him being broke. He was getting money from a series of different private investment firms and hedge funds who were using his music library, his portfolio of music that he owned, as collateral for loans that were extremely large loans. So why is that a danger? Why is it a danger when a bunch of non-banks are making loans? Well, when you get into risky trading, so in the 1970s and 1980s, real estate limited partnerships had a bad issue, but that's kind of an unknown area. There's a really easy to recognize area right now. Cryptocurrency is often not purchased using only your own money. It's quite often purchased using borrowed money from a crypto exchange that expects to have that money back. And as much of that money that's out there that's borrowed, that's a shadow bank. If that money doesn't get returned, it has an effect on the US dollar currency. Money disappearing from the system causes the dollar to go up in value. There's more demand for something that there's less of. So private banking could be a really easy way of pointing at all of the stable coins out there. In the 1970s, another very common finger pointing at shadow banking was the money market world. There's a lot more regulation on it now than there used to be, but money markets are institutions that make loans. Often they're making loans to the federal government. They're buying treasuries or they're buying corporate bonds, but that's a loan to a corporation or a loan to the government, and they're using your money to do it with. They're paying interest. So regulations on that proceeded. The stuff that's happening in the crypto market is likely going to get regulated as well, especially if it's trying to peg to a dollar.
You mentioned the money markets. There was a little scare in the money markets a while back, and as a result, the regulations on money markets clamped down pretty hard. So, which is one of the reasons, by the way, you get such low returns in money market funds today compared to what you got in the past, is the fact that they are required to keep reserves. They're required to do it. The SEC watches them pretty carefully. Money market funds, as they are in banks, are insured and regulated and heavily, and it's a whole different animal than the money market mutual fund. But the money market mutual fund is pretty heavily regulated right now. And while there is no insurance on a money market mutual fund, what we saw in the past is a couple of times when money market mutual funds got kind of on shaky grounds, the Treasury actually stepped in and rescued them. Now, that's not to imply that they'll do it again. We don't know if they'll do it again or not. You want to know one of the biggest shadow banking, maybe not the biggest, it used to be the biggest, but one of the biggest shadow banking industries in the United States is the insurance companies.
Yeah.
If you have a 401k and you have a stable value fund.
That's what most people think of as cash in their 401k.
Right. So you've got a stable value fund, and if you read the fine print on the stable value fund, it says that if you said, I want my money back, I want to liquidate here, you may have to wait 6 months. Because what you've got in there is guaranteed insurance contracts.
Now, guaranteed just means they're guaranteed by the one that's giving the loan. I guarantee I'll pay this back, but it's the same as signing a loan document.
So when you loan money to an insurance company through a GIC, or you loan money to an insurance company by putting a lot of money in a fixed annuity of some kind, that is also a shadow bank. Are they regulated? Yes, they're regulated by whatever state where they're domiciled. But that regulation is considerably less onerous and extensive than is done at the federal level for regular money market funds. So what happens is—
Or even
is,
at banks. Banks are far, far higher regulated.
Banks are farther— If you look at the interest rates, when you loan your money to somebody, which you do anytime you buy a bond, if you look at the interest rates on them, the higher the interest rate you're getting on that deposit, there's a pretty strong rule here, the lower the regulatory oversight on that industry or that in that particular entity. And if you're getting an above market interest rate on a fixed loan to an insurance company or to anywhere else, you are assuming a greater level of risk. And that's the shadow banking industry.
And I can lay this out. The shadow banking industry is getting money from pretty traditional sources, Wall Street, pension funds. Some of these, the interest rates are out of this world high. So there are pension funds in Texas, based in Texas, that are funding payday loans and car title loans at small corporations, lots of them all over Texas, where you go in and you get like a 47% interest rate over a two-month period. What you just said about the higher the interest rate, the less well-regulated. Well, these loans come right to the edge of regulation, are barely regulated. They basically, you're just signed where you're going to give your firstborn child to someone because you don't have enough money to pay your credit card this month. It's bad. And there's big money going into it because it provides big money. So what's the danger in shadow banking? Now we've established that it's out there. What's the danger of it? Just like the regulation has a relationship with the interest rate, so does the risk. And if we are in a place where there's lots and lots of low interest rate, and then you have the choice to go to a really high interest rate, and people don't know the difference, they just say, oh, this is paying more, I'll go to that. That comes with risk. Why is it that, just go back to, if you're getting a loan and you have a choice between three places, will you go with the one that's going to charge you the lowest rate or the highest rate? Well, you want to go to the lowest rate. If you're the one getting a loan, you don't say, no, I want a higher interest rate on my mortgage. I want to make a higher payment every month, even though I'm making the same principal payment. No, you don't say that. Neither do corporations. Nobody goes out there and says, I want the most expensive loan possible. So why do they take an expensive loan? Because it's the only one available because they're higher risk. If your credit score is really low, you're not going to get a high interest or low interest rate mortgage. You're going to, if you get a mortgage at all. So the same thing is out there when we're looking at shadow banks. If you're out there and you can't get a normal loan because nobody in a highly regulated area is going to charge as low as they're supposed to charge and take the risk that you are, you've got to go somewhere else. You got to go to a pawn shop or a payday loan place. That's why the interest rates are so high. It's also why, when people say, I'm going to do an owner-financed mortgage, the interest rate tends to be a lot higher than going to a bank because most people that take an owner-financed loan can't get a loan from a normal bank. So the interest rate will be higher. We've got some other stuff to talk about, the world of trade happening, but it's really that. The lower the price, the more likely is the people are going to go to it. And we got to play some commercials. If you would like to join the conversation, we've got a couple of other things hanging out there and a lot to talk about this week. But if you'd like to join and ask us some questions, the email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important words from our sponsors. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We are taking questions if you've got them. The email addresses in here are jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com.
Let's talk about recession a moment. There's a lot of fear that, as a matter of fact, the declines in the market, the people who are selling when surveyed so far, have suggested that they're concerned that we're going to have a recession, that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates and too much and too soon, and it will drive us into a recession, and companies will start losing money, and therefore they're selling their stocks. Mark Zandi has got some very good, and by the way, Mark Zandi is pretty famous. He's at economy.com, Moody's, and he is pretty famous because he has done a very good job of forecasting economic downturns for the last 40 years or so with eerie accuracy. He was one of the few people that forecast the 2008-2009 downturn accurately, and pretty much has a handle on what went on and why it went on, and continues to do so. He says, yeah, being worried about a recession when the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates makes sense. However, he's looked at the situation very, very carefully and concluded that the chances of us having anything other than an extremely mild recession are vanishingly low. And he's had some, I think, some pretty good reasons for that. One of the big things is this is an externally caused situation we're in. It's a combination of what happened in Asia, what happened economically as we've switched from buying lots of stuff, goods, to stopping buying goods and starting to buy services. These are whiplash effects that are going on in the United States economy, and it's causing part of the problem. The big one right now, though, is the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and that's driven the price of oil up. Those are the reasons we're having inflation. The Federal Reserve is raising rates, but the point, this is an important point, the Federal Reserve rates are still below neutral, meaning they're still providing some stimulus to the economy, and they're gradually raising those rates. Well, that would be, they've discussed maybe raising them a little above neutral to slow the economy down, but here's the point. Household debt service, and remember, in the United States, our GDP is driven primarily by consumers. And when consumers have more money to spend, the economy does well. When they have less money to spend, the economy does less well in the United States. It's a bottom line factual thing. For the past 40 years, the debt service of the average household has run around 11 to 12%. In other words, of the take-home available spending money that a household has, they're spending between 11 and 12% paying on debts they have already incurred. Currently, that is down to about 9.2%. Why is it so low? Well, during the pandemic, people paid off a lot of credit card debt. They paid off a lot of debts in general. And this is a big one. A lot of people have mortgages. And a lot of people, everybody that had a brain, I think, refinanced their mortgage to some absurdly low interest rate, and their house payment went down. Yay! And that means they have more money to spend. And when people have more money to spend, the economy does better. Add to that the fact that we're going into this interest rate rise with record savings levels in the United States. I mean, all-time record since we've been keeping records on these things, both in terms of dollars, which obviously can be misleading, but also in terms of income. In other words, if you look at the percentage of people's income that they have socked away, it's just amazing. It's wonderful. Now, there's always the danger, and Japan certainly has encountered that danger in the past, that people will sock away a lot of money, interest rates will go up, and they'll just keep socking away money, and they'll stop spending the money. And when they stop spending the money, we go into recession. This happens. That's something, if you want to be afraid of something, you can be afraid of. But here's the point. There is every survey that's out there, and every retailer that is contacted who sells long-term durable goods. Now, what's a long-term durable good? A long-term durable good, the primary one I can think of is an automobile or a pickup truck, are saying they have a lot more demand than they have supply. How do we know? They're saying that. How do we know it's true? The inventories on car lots have not increased. The orders for cars have. So people are willing to wait for months to get an automobile. And there's a lot of people who haven't bought automobiles, who are looking, who said, I would love to buy an automobile, but I want some immediate gratification, so I'm not going to buy right now. So once the chip shortage resolves itself, and it will, then we're going to find ourselves in the position where there's a tremendous demand in the economy, and people will have money to back up that demand. One of the things, and we mentioned this in the newsletter, that's important to be aware of, is we have had a lot of people being hired in the United States. Unemployment remains at 3.6%, which, oddly enough, I have read is an indication we're going to have a recession. We added 390,000 new employees in May in the United States. That's the first estimate that came out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I'd love to work there.
You just want to be a bureaucrat.
Yeah, I'd love to be a bureaucrat. Either the Bureau of Economic Analysis sounds even more fun. A bunch of analytical, bunch of anal people in sitting around in rooms with green eye shades. Wow, that'd be cool. Anyway, so what we've got is a tremendous amount. Manufacturing is up. Spending is up. The PMI, the Purchasing Manager Index, in both services and goods are still sitting way above 50, which indicates growth coming down the road. All of these indicators tell us we're probably not going to have a recession in the near future, but I can forecast something we will have in the near future. You want me to do that?
Sure. Yeah, I want to hear it.
In about a minute and 30 seconds, the news is going to play.
Whoa. I'm going to test you for your accuracy on this later. I'm going to replay this recording and see if you were correct.
And that will mark the end of our first hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on today, which is June 4th. And the Personal Wealth Coach, as we said at the beginning, is not just a radio program. We're also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas. We do business all over the country. And we advise people on investments. We advise people on finances. And we manage investment portfolios for people. And if you would like to contact us during the weekend, we have voicemail. But during the week, we have live people that answer the phone, not a phone tree. And you can contact us at 254-947-1111 or
1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There you're going to find our newsletters going back. You can sign up to receive our newsletter or just read it there. You can listen to our radio programs going back if you didn't get your dose of insanity from listening to us right now. You can also go to any place where podcasts are offered and you search for TPWC and we'll be there. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.